The following is a copy of a tape recording taken at the Top of Texas Roundup at Amarillo, Texas, October in 1959. Talk is given by Chuck C. of Beverly Hills and Laguna, California. Copies of this tape and other Alcoholics Anonymous meetings obtained from W.J. Van Vechten, 1060 Logan Street, Denver 3, Colorado.
And good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I am Chuck C., an alcoholic, who, by the grace of God, through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, has not had to take a drink of liquor or a sedating pill of any kind for almost 14 years. I would be remiss indeed if I didn't start out by thanking your committee for the opportunity of being with you. This is my third Top of Texas Roundup, and insofar as I'm concerned, at least, this is by far the best that I've ever attended. It's truly a wonderful weekend. I feel that I ought to have my head examined first for saying yes, and second for bringing my wife and Eddie Cochran down here. I think it's rather ridiculous. I'd like to clarify one point, however. My wife talked yesterday morning. When she was talking about knock down and drag out fights in my family, she was the knocker downer and the dragger out. She used to beat me until her fist turned blue, and I never hit her once in my life. God knows she needed it, but I didn't do it. I don't know why. I think I know why I never hit my our oldest son. When they used to decide that it was time for me to sober up, whether I want to or not, they put this bird on my tail. And he'd never let me out of his sight until I got sober enough to not go get another bottle. And I never hit him either, and he handled me pretty rough. But I believe that was discretion. He's bigger than I am. I hope something will come out that'll be worth listening to. There's been lots of good AA here this weekend. And I don't think that we particularly need to go into the ABCs. This morning, it's Sunday. And I reckon of all the people that live, you and I should be the most grateful and the most thankful. And I'd like to just sort of dream with you a little bit about what this thing means to me. I think it's rather significant that Bill right now is writing 12 principles to attend our third legacy. Very likely at the convention in Long Beach, the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of next July, to which I give you all a very warm invitation. Right now. The 25th International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very likely these articles, these 12 articles that go with the third legacy, will be given to us at that time. So we'll have the 12 there. And we have our 12 traditions and our program of unity. And we have our 12 steps and the program of recovery. And this is our 12th top of Texas Roundup. Maybe that's the reason it's so good. 12 seems to be a real good number. You know, there were 12 disciples a long time ago. And they did a pretty good job, too. And so, I like to think a little, particularly in these last 2.5 years, of the meaning sort of behind all of this. Before and after this drinking and this sobriety period in my life. We're most fortunate now in that we live up on a hill above Laguna Beach. We're about 500 feet above the ocean, I reckon. And we have a great big picture window, big thing, that looks out over the town of Laguna and over the ocean and over the islands. And as my good wife said yesterday, I can sit there and looking in one direction, I see the mountains. And in another direction, I see the flat. And another direction, the water. And the islands. And looking up, I can see the heavens. And this is just about all that God created. And I can see it right out of my big window. And I rather think sometimes that looking out that window, I also see God. And I've been thinking much about the meaning of our lives. And I often say when I'm yakking that we must get self-honest enough that we can see that if there be fault, it is mine. If there be fault, it is mine. And sitting up there in that window of mine, it seems to me, maybe, that we cannot place the fault. I think that the reason that I have lived as I have lived is because of the combination that came with me when I was born. I do not believe that it was by choice that I was as I was. I think it's because of the combination of characteristics that I was born with. It was not by choice that I was a perfectionist, an idealist. This came with me. It was not by choice that I had within me that great feeling, that great something that says life can be beautiful. This came with me. The only words that I can think of that describe it, I think, were a couple of lines in one of Wordsworth's poems, where he said, "Not in complete forgetfulness, nor yet in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory did we come from heaven, which is our home." And it seems to me that all of God's creatures are born with an awareness inside of them that life can be beautiful. But with the alcoholic, this is an obsession. This is paramount. This is big. It was not by choice that I was born with an emotional setup that was way out of proportion. This was not by choice. It came with me. It was not by choice that there was that urge, that real drive within me to excel in everything that I did. It was not choice that I could not believe what they told me in my own religion. This was not by choice. Because it happened to me long before, I was able to choose what I would believe. And so I, from the beginning, was a nonconformist. And this was not by choice. I was a rebel. And I could not integrate myself into so-called normalcy. Because so-called normalcy has never been any good for the likes of me. And so being a misfit, it forced self-thinking. And self-thinking is insanity. I didn't know that till I got here. And so as I went down the corridors of life, these characteristics that came with me forced me to do certain things. And this emotional package that came with me caused a great hurt when things were not as I thought they should be. Life wasn't according to my pattern at all. Life should be beautiful, and it wasn't. People lied to each other. That wasn't according to my pattern. People cut each other's throats to gain their ends. And this wasn't according to my pattern. Life just simply in reality wasn't what I thought it should be. And it hurt. And it hurt bad. And so from a very tender age, I started building a wall around myself because I didn't want to get hurt. And as I walked down the path, it got worse and it got worse. And so in order to get rid of the hurt, we started chipping them off. I got hurt in Chicago, so I chipped it off. Didn't need it. I get along without Chicago, and I left. Got hurt in the club, and I didn't need it. Chipped it off. Got hurt in business. Boss, didn't need him. Chipped him off. Got hurt in the social world in which I lived. Chipped it off. So, right down the line, I was chipping off. And the circle was getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And there were fewer people in it and fewer places. And finally, there were just a few of us in it. There was me and my wife and our kids, whom I always loved, and a few more. And I wanted to keep them. But they chipped me off. And finally, there wasn't anybody in there but me. And by this time, I couldn't stand me. And so this is the result of self-thinking. That's a wonderful thing, you know. It seems like there's a great law in this life that says what the fountain pours forth returns again to the fountain. But it returns in the nature of seed. It comes back heaped up, pressed down, and running over. If you plant a grain of corn, you get 500. And so it is with this thinking deal. Self-thinking. It ends up, and all you got left is yourself. And that's bad. Because you can't stand yourself. Now, during all of this time, I was searching for an answer. Eddie talked much about this morning. Searching for an answer. And I became a system man. I thought that one of these great systems, or one of its advocates, some priest or some preacher, would be able to do this thing for me. And I tried going through the systems, I guess, for 30 years before I came to AA. My second greatest obsession was religion, its system. And I knew that here or there I was going to find my answer. And I'd go through one, and I didn't find it, and I would discard it, and I'd take up another. And nothing happened. Oh, something happened. I became known as a drunken deacon. For the last 10 years of my life, I was known as a drunken deacon. I loved to tell people how much I knew about God. Matter of fact, I'd spring for the drink if you'd sit there and listen to me. But again, thinking that some system was going to do it, nothing did it. And it was only since I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that I've learned that a system is a way to do something. And if it's a good way to do something, it's a good system. But the system itself can't do anything. You see? You got to use the system, just like we have to use the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Or it doesn't do anything for you. Well, I didn't know that. I thought the system would do it. And so I learned much about and talked much about. But I didn't know the thing itself until I came here. And if there's one thing I would say that I'd like for you to remember, it's this. In this particular problem that we have, I am an alcoholic. In this particular problem, there are certain conditions which I must fulfill, or I cannot live a sober and happy life. There are certain things for me to do. The system is good. AA is the system. But we can know the book from cover to cover and be able to recite it. And we can even believe it. And still be drunk as two skunk old cats. Until we are ready and willing to fulfill the conditions, we can't have sobriety. And this I didn't know. And so this is a matter of individual experience. As it's been said from this podium many times during this little talk. This is an inside job. This is an inside job. There are things I must do. And so, finally, I ran out of systems, and I ran out of time, too. The time came when I couldn't get out of bed and come and tell you how much I knew about these great truths. And for a philosopher of my ability, this was a sad state of affairs, I'll tell you. Real bad. Now, something had happened to me rather early in life, that soured me on the human race. People were either too mean or too stupid to merit my attention. I didn't like people. And of all peoples, I disliked drunks the most. I certainly didn't like drunks. And it was real difficult for me to imagine myself coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I had read the article by Jack Alexander in the Post in 1941, and I came here in 1945. So, I know about you, but I didn't want to come here. And I'll show you how repulsive this idea was. On my next to the last drunk, I drove 6,000 miles in a blackout. I went to Amarillo, I imagine. Twice, I imagine. But I was in a blackout. I remember about 5% of what happened. It was legitimate. I had a reason for it. Our eldest son was about to go to the Navy. And he'd never been in the hills where I was raised. And so we had planned a vacation together. I was periodic for the last 10 years of a 25-year drinking career. A periodic by choice, because I was going to whip this problem. And you can't fight a very good battle when you're down on your back. And so I became a periodic so I could get well enough to get back in the ring again. And so I've been sober for some time. And Bill and I were going to take this trip together. And so it came time to go. And I left the office, going on a vacation. Feeling good, money in my pocket. And I thought, well, a little drink would be real good. And so I got a pint, and I drank it on the way home. And then I got another pint, because I had to pack. And I drank that while I was packing. And when I got ready to get in the car, took out my suitcase, Bill and his suitcase were in the car. And he took one look at me, and he says, Dad, you're drunk. Oh, I said, no, I'm not drunk. Vacation, we're going to have fun. And I had a couple of drinks, but I'm not drunk. He says, you're drunk, and I'm not going with you. And I pled with him, and he wouldn't go. And so he took his suitcase and got out of the car. Well, he couldn't do that to his poor old dad. So I went without him. Now, I remember a few very little things that happened. I remember waking up down at the bottom of one of your canyons, either in New Mexico, Arizona, or someplace down here. And it was dark, and the train was coming, and the whistle was blowing, and the lights went right over the front of the car, and the bells were ringing. And I thought, well, this is it. But I couldn't do anything about it. But the train went by, missed me by one coat of paint. And so I reached under the seat and pulled out a fifth and drank till daylight and cased the situation. And I saw very distinctly that you can't get there from here. I couldn't even have gotten down there, let alone get out. And so there wasn't anything to do but drink. Well, the next time I woke up, I was in jail in southern Illinois. So I reckon I drove out of the place. I don't know. And I remember being home, and I remember my mother and dad. They were pretty old at that time, and they were heartbroken. They couldn't even talk to me. They were crying. Broke their hearts. And I was too drunk even to talk. And I remember a few little things, and then I got home. And I went to bed, and I finished my drunken bed, drinking the clock around. Now, this was my pattern in the last 10 years. Always I ended up my drunks in bed, drinking the clock around. And I never quit until I couldn't even roll out of bed to get another bottle. And then I had to quit. And then I had to die a lot of times, because I never knew an easy way to sober up until I got into AA. Thank God. I might still be out in left field if I'd have known how to sober up without sweating, freezing, dying, shaking my liver out for days on end. But this time came, and I had to quit, and maybe 48 hours after my last drink, I was able to go to the kitchen to get a bath of buttermilk. And Mrs. C and our youngest son were sitting in the living room, and they heard me let out a beller, and they heard me hit the floor. So they came running out. And this time I wasn't chewing my tongue and babbling like an idiot. I was just lying there, blue as an old piece of slate. And they couldn't wake me up. And so they got the oxygen squad, and they came down and eventually brought me around. And incidentally, they told me not to do that anymore. They were against it. And maybe it's 48 hours after this that I am able to get the old dirty bathrobe on and start walking. Walking up and down the living room. 2 weeks beard on. Not exactly smelling like a rose. And walking and sweating and freezing and dying. And Mrs. C was standing over the fireplace. And I remember, as if it were yesterday, I was walking away from her at the time. And so she said to me, "Chuck, don't you think you might get a little help if you'd read the book Alcoholics Anonymous?" And it was just as if she'd hit me right smack between the eyes with a ball bat. And I looked around at her and I says, "You, my very old wife, suggesting that I read a book written by a bunch of drunks. I who have read all the good books by the good authors. Why," I says, "you wound me deeply." "How insane can you get? I've just been dead 48 hours before. You wound me deeply." And I polished it off by saying, "And besides, I can write a better book than that myself." See, I didn't want to come here. This is the last place I ever wanted to go. And it came back close to being the last place I ever went. Now, this is just about 2 months before I came crawling into AA. I turned blue. And still, this wasn't enough. I got drunk once more. But right in the middle of this drunk, I had been drunk from the Friday before Christmas till the middle of January. And I mean drunk. Just emptying bottles. Just emptying bottles. Mrs. C would tell you that it took 7 quarts of whiskey to keep me down 3 days. Every 3 days, I'd empty 7 quarts. Now, I don't know. But she does. And that's all I'd been doing from the Friday before Christmas to the middle of January. And I woke up in the middle of January one morning with a clear head. The clearest head I've ever known in my life for about 15 minutes, maybe. And for the first time in my life, I saw me without an excuse at all. I just saw me. Now, in these last years, priests and preachers and doctors have all told me that this is not uncommon when a man is dying. That oftentimes when we're dying, we're given the ability to see ourselves as we are. And if we make the right decision, we come back. And if we make the wrong one, we go overboard. This I don't know. I only know what happened to me. And I want to tell it because to me it is most significant. I saw me and it was a pretty dirty thing to look at. And I knew without knowing why that I was all done. That I'd lost the battle of life. And that I couldn't get out of it alone. And I knew why my good wife after 20 years was divorcing me. And I knew she should have done it 10 years before. And I knew why our children wouldn't come home unless they had to when I was around. And we're just waiting until the time I was legally restrained from blighting their lives. And I knew why my boss had sent word that if I ever returned, he was going to throw me through the plate glass window. And the window don't open. And I completely and totally accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone. And that I was not entitled to have it back. And it suddenly became very necessary for me to be sober until I died. Now, I knew that I was going to die momentarily. I doubted that I ever get out of the bed. But I must be sober till I died. And I had only one reason for being sober, for wanting to be sober. And that was that I didn't want to die with a record. I wanted to rub out as much as I could of what I had written on the blackboard of life before I left. And that's the only reason that I had for sobriety. And the last thing that went through my mind was this. I remembered that I had read Jack Alexander's article in the Post. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find Alcoholics Anonymous. And then the curtain came down, and I was again insane. And I had a lot of days and a lot of nights to die. But from that moment until this, it has never been necessary for me to take another drink of liquor. This is the only time in the last 10 years of my drinking that I ever sobered up with liquor in the house. And I knew where it was. And so, when I was able, I started hunting Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, Mrs. C. and I didn't know anything about this society. And we didn't have sense enough to look in the phone book, thinking it was an anonymous fellowship. And so we started calling people and asking them if they knew anyone that knew anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we finally got a telephone number. And I called a man. And he was a motion picture actor. Most of you know him. And he was working on a picture. And he said to me, have you had a drink today? And I said, no. He said, don't take one, and maybe tomorrow I can take you to a meeting. And this went along for several days. And I got panicky. And I said to him, Kent, you don't need to take me to a meeting. Where can I go? I'll go. So you see, I never had the advantage of a sponsor as such. And nobody had ever told me that if I got sober in this wonderful program, that many miracles would happen. Nobody had ever told me because I hadn't talked with them. And so I found where there was a meeting and it was a Sunday night just like this. And I went to the meeting alone. I have heard some words, some talking about aloneness in this conference. But if there is a word that I understand, it's alone. I suspect that the nearest I will ever come to know a meaning for the word absolute is the absolute aloneness of an alcoholic who's run out of time. And so I pulled my hat down over my face and turned the collar of my coat up around my neck because I didn't know what I was going to find. And I went to AA for one thing and one thing only. I must be sober. I didn't come here to find God. I didn't come here to get my wife back. I knew she was gone and should be. Or to get my kids back. I knew they were gone and should be. I didn't come here to get help. Peace of mind and serenity of purpose were not even words. I came for one thing, sobriety. And I looked into this room full of people through the door. And it was before the meeting had started. And they were all yakking just like you were. And I don't think I could have stood up here this morning after this wonderful, wonderful talk that we just had. But I closed my eyes and I listened to y'all yakking. This does something to me that nothing else in the world can do, I reckon. This happy chatter. You can't hear a word that's said. But it's all happy chatter. And it just sends me through the ceiling. And it gave me the courage to get up. And I heard this, and I said to myself, they've given me the wrong dope. This meeting was in the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. And I said to myself, these are the veterans and their wives. And they're here for a party. Because you didn't look like me. And you didn't feel like me. And I was greatly discouraged. And I thought I was going to have to go away and come back the night the drunks were there. And I was just about to take off when a man came up to me. And he said, mister, were you looking for somebody? I said, no, sir. He said, what were you looking for? And I said, I was looking for sobriety. And the guy lit up like a church. Why, he says, take off that hat and coat. You're in the right place. And there'll never be more beautiful words in the English language to me than this. Take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. And they shared their experience, strength, and hope with me, a stranger. Before I got out of that room that night, I had decided I wanted what you had. And I had become willing to go to any length to get it. But I had a great fear upon me. I was pretty sure I'd done too much damage to my body and to my mind to get it. I knew I wanted it more than life. But I didn't think I could have it. And so for the next 6 months, I was in a meeting every night, carrying this great fear that I couldn't have this thing. And yet, after 6 months of meetings, I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been all the time. And this was the greatest awakening in my life. And that's 13 years and a little better ago. And so, from then until now, I've been waking up to the fact that this had happened, and that had happened, and the other thing had happened. And there's been little but good that's happened in my life for 14 years. And so, this is what I want to talk about a little this morning. This sharing of our experience, strength, and hope, one with another, in love. Now, for a long time, I thought I was a stranger among strangers at my first meeting. And it was only sitting up there looking out at that big window that it came to me that I was the only stranger in the room. You see, I didn't know me, and I didn't know my problems, and therefore I couldn't know you. But you were alcoholics. And you knew the problem. And you knew the answer. And you knew me. So I walked into a room full of relatives. And you shared your experience, strength, and hope with me in love. And I began to feel something way down in the middle of me that says maybe. Maybe you belong here. Mind you, I didn't want to come. And this at the first meeting, maybe you belong here. And at every meeting to which I returned, this feeling grew. Sure enough, I belonged here. I was an alcoholic. And it grew into kinship. Kinship. Kinship first with a bunch of drunks that didn't have to drink anymore. Kinship that finally, as the months went by, included the human race. And kinship that finally, as the years went by, included God, the Father of life. A kinship. And it came about so naturally and so beautifully and so easily that I wasn't even aware that it was happening. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. The sharing of our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. And now in these recent times, I've been looking at this and thinking about it. And it seems to me, quite simply, that for 30 years, I had the cart before the horse. I wasn't interested in people. I was interested in God. And of the dregs of the human race, I most certainly was not interested in them. The drunks. And so help me, a bunch of drunks had saved my life. You see? And I got to thinking, maybe. I had the cart before the horse. And so I was sitting up there and looking out the window, and I remembered a little story. Seems to me like it's a story of a judgment day. Seems like there was a judge there. And the people were coming. And they were telling him what good things he'd done down on earth. And some of them he'd let in, and some of them he'd say, well, I never heard of you. Go on about your business. And finally some little old guy came up. And this judge looked at him, he said, go on in, son. He says, I was hungry and you fed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was thirsty, and you gave me the drink. And the old boy says, oh, you must have me mixed up with somebody else. I never saw you before. And the judge says to him, inasmuch as you did it to the least of these, you did it also unto me. Go on in. And I thought, this is AA. And I thought, maybe it's in sharing our experiences one with another in love that we come to know love. And they say God is love. And then I was thinking a little bit further, and I remembered something like this. I haven't read it recently, and it may be wrong. But it seems like it was the last few days that the carpenter was here. And he called his very good friend Peter into his presence. And I've always sort of loved that old boy Peter. It seemed like he must have been an alcoholic. You know, he was sort of a rebel. And it seemed like Carpenter loved him best too. And he called him in and he says, Peter, do you love me? Peter says, yea, Lord. And he says to him, tend my sheep. And he asked him again, Peter, do you love me? And he says, yea, Lord. And he says, tend my sheep. And the third time he asked him, and the third time he said, tend my sheep. And I began to thinking about this, and I thought, oh, maybe it is tending the sheep that we come to know the shepherd. And this is AA. And I reckon this is the reason I love this thing so much. I reckon this is the reason that I know that this is my life. I reckon this is the reason that I'm dedicated with all that's in me to try and pass this thing along. Because it was out of my sharing with you that this good life came. This good life that includes a feeling of unity with not only you, but with our Father. And so then backing up a little, and there's something quite wonderful about it, indescribably fine. And I got to thinking about this, and it came to me that in almost every other relationship in life, there is an expectancy. If it's the wife or the husband or the kids or the boss our friends, there is an expectancy. Now, if these folks perform according to expectancy, we love them. And if they perform a little better than expectancy, we love them a little more. And if they perform less than expectancy, we write them off. And that seems true in all relationships in life. But in AA, there is no expectancy. We don't even expect each other to stay sober. Now, this is the reason we're so happy when we see each other. You see? Well, there's old Tom. He's still sober. Yeah. And it's wonderful. We just love for free and for fun. And we share that love. And I've been thinking, it isn't normal to walk alone. I walked alone for 43 years. It isn't normal to walk alone. It's normal for us to walk down the corridors of life with our arms around each other, helping each other over the rough spots, sharing our experience, strength, and hope in love. This is normal. It isn't normal for us to be in left field, away from home, away from God. This is not normal. It's normal for us to live in the Father's house and go about the Father's business, namely, practicing these principles in all of our affairs one day at a time. This is normal. And this is the reason that I believe that you and I, alcoholics, are the most fortunate peoples on earth today. Because, you see, we have an incurable disease. An incurable disease that is also progressive. And it gets worse and worse and worse. And the time comes when we can no longer get what we have to have out of the body. I can imagine nothing worse than to go to the bottle for oblivion, and that's the only place we knew to get it, and it isn't there. I could drink the stuff by the tumbler, and I couldn't get sober, and I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't live, and I couldn't die. The very stuff that I depended upon had let me down. And so I can no longer live in this state, and I come here for sobriety. And I said to find that the conditions for sobriety and the conditions for the good life and the conditions of God are one and the same set of conditions. And herein we're so fortunate, because you see, I didn't come for these other answers. I would have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on the face of the earth if it didn't include alcohol. And all of these things came with it because the conditions are the same. And what are the conditions? Nothing in the world but a personally and individually acceptable conscious partnership with the God that made it. In the business of living. And this is the only business you and I have. This is the only time we have the business of living. And it's a beautiful thing. And lastly, I got to thinking about the parallel of our beautiful program. And the program, or the story, of the prodigal son. And I love this thing, and it seems to me that it explains you to me, and it explains me to me, and it explains you and me in our relationship to God, the Father of life. And this is my story. And if I misquote it, I don't care. This is what it means to me. And I think it's just like our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Until that is my story. Until I am on the page. And until I am, here are the steps I took. Here are the steps I took. We don't get the wonderful rewards of sobriety. But when it's my program and I'm living it to the best of my ability one day at a time, the rewards are fabulous. And so it is in this little story of life. This is my story. So some like me. A certain wealthy man, God, had two sons, you and I. And the youngest one came to his dad and he says, Dad, I've got a lot of things in mind. I'm going out to California. Great land of opportunity out there. I'm going to do a lot of things. Maybe I'm even getting pictures. Give me my inheritance. Now the father didn't say, wait a minute, son. You got everything you need right here? You might get out there away from home and get into trouble. You might even run onto a blonde out there with a bottle of muscadoodle and get into bad trouble. Stay home. Everything is right here. No, the father didn't say that. The kid says, give me my inheritance. And he gave it to him. Just like that. No. And the kid went into a far country. Away from home. Away from God. And wasted his substance on riotous living. Now, maybe you didn't do that, but this sounds just like me. And after he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land, and this is most serious. But I know about those famines. I think they always happen, you know. I doubt if there was ever a famine, any more famine, than to wake up after quite a long drunk, when you're as hot as a two-bit pistol, and they're trying to bank your checks with tennis rackets all over town. That's a pretty bad famine. And the kid came to want. And the next line is terrific. Because it says, and no man gave unto him. He was beyond human help. Our book says probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Same thing. And the kid came to want. And no man gave unto him. But the next line's better than that because it says that the kid came to himself. And I remember that morning, the middle of January, 13 years ago last January. The kid came to himself. But he didn't come to himself until he had really hit bottom. He was in the pig pen, you remember. He had to have a job. He had to have something to do. And so he'd gone to a man in that country, and the man had put him to work. But he didn't put him to milking the cows. He put him to tending the pigs. Now, this is a very significant thing. Because, you see, this was a Jew boy telling this story, and they don't like pigs at all. They simply don't like pigs. And here he was in the pig pen. And he fain would eat the husk that the pigs did eat. I think I know about that pig pen. I think sometimes that the only place that the likes of me can find this thing is in the pig pen. And so the kid looked at himself. And he saw what a bad job he'd done with the business with. And he said to himself, I'm a failure. And on that morning, I realized that I was not only a failure as a drunk, but I was a failure in every department of life. A failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, a man, and a drunk. And so, The kid says I'm a bad boy. I've sinned against God and against man, and I'm no good. But he remembered in his desperation that in his father's house was plenty and to spare. But he says, I can't go back and ask my father to take me on as his son. I forfeited that privilege. And I'm mindful of myself. Because when I read that third step, I said to me, this is wonderful. But you can't do it. You can't do it. You can't give this mess to anybody. I had no objection to it. I would have turned my will and my life over to the care of a jackass if I could have gotten rid of me. But I didn't think I had any right to try to give this mess to God. Had no objection, mind you. So I said, maybe, if I do these simple things, something will happen. And so the kid says to himself, I'll go back. The hired servants there have more than I do. And I'll just ask Dad to put me on as a hired servant. And so he made a decision. He says, I will arise and go to my father. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, as we understood it, the same thing. And so the kid got up and started home. And here then, to my mind, is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the father saw him a long ways off and came to meet him. Oh, my beloved, if we could just see that we don't have to go through a lot of contortions to find God. How can we find God when he isn't lost? And so, all we need to do is fulfill the conditions. And God comes to meet us. And he came to meet me through a bunch of drunks that didn't have to drink anymore, who shared their experience, strength, and hope in love. This is the miracle of AA, the Spirit of Almighty God working through his children. And so the father came, and the kid started trying to tell him what a bad boy he'd been. And again, the father didn't hear him. He didn't say, yes, I know, I've got the books right here. You certainly turned out to be a louse. I know every time you got into the heights. I know everything that you've done, I've got the record. And you sure are a bad boy. Now take the grubbing hoe and get back on the back 40. Start digging for cinnamon sprouts and sassafras bushes. And maybe in about 25 years, if you do a good job, I'll invite you in to have lunch with me. No, he didn't say that. He didn't hear the kid at all. He fell on his neck and kissed him. And he put a ring on his finger, the symbol of eternal life. No end and no beginning. And he called to the servants and he says, kill the fatted calf. The boy was lost. And he's come back home. Let's have a point. That God could and would if he was so. And so the answer to the disease of alcoholism and the answer to the riddle of life are one and the same answer. I am convinced that it is God's will for his kids that we have fulfillment, peace, and joy as our inheritance, if you will. This is God's will for us. But not on my terms, on his. And what are his terms? Nothing in the world, but that I act like his kid. That I go about my father's business. And this is the only business I have. And this is the business that you have put me in. By the grace of God. This is the great answer to life. Again, it is not normal to walk alone. And I haven't had to walk alone since my first meeting. Some part of you went with me. It is not normal. To outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver. In order to eke out a miserable living out of an unfriendly evening. It's normal to live to add to life. To the best of our ability one day at a time. And it's just as normal for God to take care of. Now in the 13 years and several months that I've been here, without any attempt to bring it about, everything that I had hoped for and everything that I had beaten my brains out to get in 43 years and ended up without is now mine. My good wife and I have had 13 of the most beautiful years you've ever known. Our son's both larger than myself. Follow me around. Like it. I had the same boss for 11 years that came in January to throw me out of the building. The same boss. But what a different experience. And today, I own the business that he came in to throw me out. I feel a little sinful. You can imagine that. But that's the way it happened. This is my story. Yes, there is sobriety here. But there's infinitely more. Just as the disease is twofold, the answer is twofold. And we get physical sobriety, and we get spiritual rest, because we rest in each other and in Him. Terrific. And in the very doing, we learn the great truth that He announced so long ago. It's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. Fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. Don't be afraid of this thing. Don't be afraid of this thing. Don't think that we have to hold out a little. Because it's only as we give off that we get off.